Hello, welcome to the Environment Show. Coming up, we'll talk to one of the leaders of the International Arctic Ocean Expedition 1991. The participants will study everything from the Arctic Ocean floor to the water temperature and salinity to air pollution.
The springtime, for instance, the air in the Arctic north of Alaska has been shown to be more or less equivalent to Cleveland. It's air pollution is fairly serious up there in the early spring, because that's when these air masses from the temperate latitudes, the industrialized latitudes, are swept up into the Arctic.
Scientists from six nations are joining forces to crack open the secrets of the Arctic. We'll get the facts on a new refrigerator compressor that does its part to protect the ozone layer. And do you dread the day you have to drag all your returnable bottles and cans back to the store? Never fear, recycling vending machines may soon be coming to a store near you. Some of the stories this time on The Environment Show. We hope you'll stay tuned. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. This is Melissa Rocker. Three of the most powerful ice-breaking ships in the world are set to leave Tromsø, Norway in mid-August, embarking on an international Arctic Ocean expedition. Environment Show correspondent Nancy Marshall reports scientists aboard the ships are undertaking one of the most thorough examinations ever of the Arctic Ocean itself, the air above it, and the seafloor beneath it.
More than 100 scientists from six nations are participating in the expedition. The project was proposed by Sweden, which had just completed building a new icebreaker. Germany and the United States then offered their icebreakers. Only the U.S. and German ships will travel and work together. The Swedish vessel, according to expedition co-chief scientist Dr. Leonard Johnson of the U.S. Office of Naval Research, will concentrate on environmental concerns. Scientists aboard the Swedish vessel will be taking measurements of the ocean's temperature and salinity, looking for evidence of global warming. They'll also measure pollutants in the Arctic. One possible effect of global warming would be a thinning of the layer of ice coating the Arctic. Dr. Johnson says that could alter worldwide weather patterns.
Sea ice itself would not change sea level, but what it would change would be the amount of reflection of the Earth's, of the sun coming into the Earth. And with a lot of open water up there, you're going to have more of a flux, and that means more moisture is going to get into the air, there's going to be more rainfall, and it's going to shift your weather patterns because of this. And, for instance, it's been widely put in the press that if there were no sea ice, it would probably be considerably drier in our Midwest area, for instance. But these, again, are all computer models, and we don't know really how valid they are. But, yes, it's bound to affect the northern hemisphere climate if all the sea ice were to go away, because it's going to change the atmospheric patterns considerably to have warm or relatively warm open water instead of snow and ice up on the Arctic Ocean.
Scientists on the Swedish vessel will also be looking at the air quality of the Arctic, which deteriorates drastically during the spring.
Most of your Arctic air pollution comes from the mid-latitudes, from the industrialized parts of Europe and the Soviet Union, and to some extent the United States. It's particularly severe in the springtime. We'll be there in the summer, so it won't be so severe. But in the springtime, for instance, the air in the Arctic north of Alaska has been shown to be more or less equivalent to Cleveland. It's air pollution is fairly serious up there in the early spring, because that's when these air masses from the temperate latitudes, the industrialized latitudes, are swept up into the Arctic.
The Swedish ship's crew is also scheduled to examine the effect large rivers have on the Arctic. Dr. Johnson says three major waterways flow into the Arctic Ocean, carrying nutrients as well as pollutants with them. Once again, scientists aboard the Swedish vessel will study the pollution, and those on Dr. Johnson's ship, as well as the German vessel, will examine how the rivers affect the biology of the Arctic.
There are a number of rivers flowing into the Arctic. There are three very large ones on the Soviet side, and we will be looking at the water column to analyze the nutrients and to analyze the chemistry of these waters and to see what effect they have on the biology and the biomass of the eastern Arctic. Dr. Honcho thinks they have a very major effect. And again, this is tends to be hypothesis without too many facts, and so we're trying to back up these hypotheses, to explore these hypotheses with facts.
Dr. Susumi Honjo is the expedition's other co-chief scientist. He works out of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Dr. Johnson says he and Dr. Honjo's team will also be ground-truthing satellites. Ground-truthing confirms what scientists infer from satellite pictures. According to Johnson, they will also be able to expand upon satellite information. For example, a satellite picture will show the presence of ice. Johnson and his team will try to determine what type of ice is pictured, how much salinity it contains, and what type of sediment and frozen organisms have been trapped in it. Another assignment for the scientists aboard the U.S. and German ships, the planting of a network of buoys that will send information by satellite to Woods Hole, the Office of Naval Research, and locations in Germany and Japan. Dr. Johnson says the buoys will measure air temperature and the amount of wind and snow in the Arctic for at least the next year and a half.
We have buoys from several sources. There's some from the Naval Oceanographic Office. There's some from Germany. There's some from Woods Hole and some from Japan. The Woods Hole ones are particularly sophisticated. And in this case, it's one very large buoy, and then the Japanese have built just about a duplicate of it. So we have these two very sophisticated buoys, which, among other things, they look at the air temperature, they look at the wind on the top of the ice, they look at the amount of snow, the rate that the snow is melting, the rate that the ice is melting or growing. They have devices hanging within the water column that tell about the temperature and salinity as it changes in time and depth. They have current meters to measure the velocity. They have also devices to measure the biological productivity and the sediment flux, that is the amount of sediment or debris, organic debris, or if it's little bits of rock melting through the ice that are actually falling down toward the seafloor. These are caught, and they're caught in a sort of a cone-shaped device that every 2 weeks changes its collection unit so that you have a two-week average over a year or so. These will be put in, and they will be left to drift out. We're anticipating that they should drift out in about a year and a half, and they will be then picked up. They have satellite information on them so that we will know where they are at all times, talking to the French satellite. And they will also be delivering a lot of their data via satellite. So those are the two big ones. The smaller ones mainly are for temperature and air pressure and for location, so we can see the rate and the direction with which the ice drifts in response to the winds. By pressure, you can tell or you can infer the wind field. And so we will set these out in a very large array and basically try to cover from very near the Svalbard archipelago all the way up as close to the pole as we can get. We'll put in a long array of all these buoys in a big coordinated field.
Scientists from all over the world will have access to data from the buoys via a computer network. Members of Dr. Johnson's expedition will also be studying the geology and geophysics of the ocean floor. They'll drill into the sea bottom and bring up intact samples of it, which are called sediment cores. From those, researchers hope to determine when the Arctic got cold. It actually used to be warm up there.
We know it was still ice up there 5 million years ago, and about 40 million years ago it was warm. We have no data in between that time. It's a long period of time, but obviously the Arctic got cold at that sometime during that time frame. We don't know whether it was quick or whether it was a gradual deterioration. Did it oscillate? That information is not available, and the best place to get it is in marine sediment cores, because the fauna and flora, which are preserved in the sediments, will give you an indication whether it was warm water or cold water, And if there was ice, you can see the debris, the small rock fragments which are dropped from the floating sea ice. So that is one of the big things we want to find out is when did the Arctic get cold? And when you know when and when you know how it got cold, then perhaps you can start thinking about the forcing functions which made it cold. And the other aspect of this is we had some ridges, underwater ridges on the Arctic, which are comparable to the Alps in size. I mean, they're big. And we have no samples from these whatsoever. So there is, of course, speculation as to what they're made of, but there's no hard samples. And we hope to sample these if we are able to get that far in.
The expedition has a good chance of making it to the ridges. Several icebreakers working together are more effective than one trying to forge a path through the ice. All three icebreakers will return to Tromso October 10th. Dr. Leonard Johnson of the U.S. Office of Naval Research is the Arctic Expedition's co-chief scientist. For the Environment Show, I'm Nancy Marshall.
The Japanese electronics firm Matsushita is ready to offer on the market a new type of refrigerator compressor that does not use the chemical compound chlorofluorocarbon. The compound, commonly called CFC, is thought to be a major threat to the protective ozone atmosphere around the Earth. Bruce Robertson has more.
The Montreal Protocol mandates a reduction by 50% the amount of CFC-12 used by manufacturers. The international agreement specifies this should be accomplished by 1995. The text further spells out that CFC-12 should be eliminated entirely by 2000. The Montreal document does specify that hydrofluorocarbon, or HFC-134A, is to be used as a substitute. Though HFC-134A has been available, there has not been an acceptable means to use it until now. Recently, the Japanese electronics giant Matsushita announced a breakthrough in technology enabling HFC-134A to be used. Speaking to us from the Matsushita U.S. headquarters in Secaucus, New Jersey, Joseph Taylor, General Manager for Appliance Materials, explains that Matsushita did not invent the compound, rather the machinery to use it.
From our standpoint, the breakthrough was developing a compressor that would operate on this new refrigerant. And the problem with doing that from our standpoint was that this refrigerant involved not only changing some materials within the compressor itself, but also finding a lubricating oil that was compatible with it. But we did not develop the refrigerant itself, nor did we on our own develop the lubricating oil. The lubricating oil was kind of a collaborative effort with our engineers and petroleum engineers. But the refrigerant, we had nothing to do with that development. That was done by the DuPonts and the ICIs and those kinds of people, the chemical people.
The problem with CFC compounds is in the chlorine molecule. Chlorine is believed to be the real culprit in ozone destruction. HFC has no chlorine. Taylor says both compounds function the same way as a coolant, though.
What refrigerant, as we define it here, does, refrigerant is a liquid compound that will absorb heat. Then what we do through the refrigeration cycle is essentially the liquids boil to a vapor through compression, and then the vapor is compressed at the same time to a high temperature and pressure vapor. And then when this vapor passes through a cooling medium, then the vapor gives up its heat and condenses. That's a basic refrigerant cycle. Both of these refrigerants, the function is exactly the same. It's to condense and boil and expand and contract and give off and absorb heat. That's a basic refrigeration cycle, and that's what both of these refrigerants do.
Though both compounds are effective, chlorine was most efficient and thus hardware was developed to use chlorine. What is interesting, as Taylor points out, it has not really been a question of unavailable technology.
You know, if you'll go back, no one understood years ago that there was any problem environmentally with CFC. And so it wasn't a matter of lacking or not lacking or which is better or which is worse. This is the way that it had been done. Then I think when it was discovered that CFCs were creating potential environmental problems, that's when the industries in general looked at what alternatives might be available. And I think when the CFC, when it was identified that it was chlorine causing the problem, the question is, well, what can we use as a refrigerant that removes the chlorine from the process? So, again, I think the refrigerant guys, most of this, from this standpoint, stands, at least from the early stages, how we ended up with HFCs is really a question to ask the refrigerant manufacturers. All we did is we took what the refrigerant manufacturers, the compound that they said will solve the problem from an ozone depletion standpoint, and they said to us, here's what we have as a refrigerant. Will it work in a system? So we took this compound, and as we first started using it, that's how we determined, well, there's some problems of compatibility with the existing oils that are used as a lubrication, and also with some of the materials, particularly like rubber compounds within the compressor. And that's when we had to develop, through internal use and external people, alternative materials and oils to counteract that so that we could still use the refrigerant that was available to us.
It was a very detailed process to develop this new coolant system. As a manufacturer of all the various components of cooling systems, Matsushita was in a position to determine not only that the new compound would not work in existing compressor technology, but further to develop new hardware that would work with HFC-134A. Taylor says the new coolers are in the field testing stage at this point, after refrigerator manufacturers have a chance to examine the new components and offer suggestions for improvements. Matsushita will begin full-scale production. Taylor says if Matsushita does its job right, we as consumers of refrigerators and air conditioners and the like will not have any idea we are using a new system. But perhaps soon we will be. This is Bruce Robertson.
In states that recycle, returning cans to the supermarket can be a messy, tedious job. Now an alternative is starting to appear in many cities. It's called Cans for Cash, and it looks and operates like a vending machine. The machine is produced by a company called Environmental Products Corporation, or Envipco. Bruce DeWolfson is Envipco's president. He says he stumbled upon the idea in 1977 during a visit to Japan.
I think they call it a pedestrian observation, and that means that I was just a normal citizen without any particular expertise in recycling who observed some dock workers crushing aluminum cans with sledgehammers so that they could put them on ship board and take them back to their home port for recycling. And watching that process and knowing about the cost of the labor involved, it told me that there had to be a better way to compact empty aluminum cans for recycling. And so I began to think and do research on the subject and came up with the idea of an automated device that would compact the empty containers.
DeWolfson started designing an aluminum can crusher in 1979, and the first one was installed in San Diego 3 years later. He says it wasn't a huge success at first, mainly because the machines could not make a profit with only voluntary recycling. But the machines have worked in the 10 states they have deposits on containers. Instead of waiting in line for a person to take their cans, customers can drop them in the vending machine in exchange for their refund. DeWolfson explains how they work.
What happens is that the consumer will come up to the can machine, for example, with his bag of returned empty cans and put them into the machine. And the machine will inspect each can and look for the brand, for example, by the Universal Product Code that's on the container, record what brand it is, and then if it finds in the electronic lookup table that that brand is a container that's worth a refund of deposit in that particular location, it will accept the container, crush it up, and drop it into a storage compartment, and then issue a refund to the consumer. Now, when the consumer is finished putting all of his containers in a particular machine, he'll push a button that basically says, please pay me now. And the consumer will receive either coin payment or he may receive a printed voucher.
There are now four different kinds of recycling vending machines. One flattens cans, another crushes glass bottles, and a third shreds plastic bottles. The fourth and newest machine shreds aluminum cans, also producing three times as much aluminum per cubic foot. Some allow the consumer to donate their refund to a local charity of the week, and others print out coupons with the refund voucher. It costs the supermarket 2% more per can to use the recycling vending machines, but DeWolfson says it's much more convenient.
Well, they are bringing them back to the store in the same way that they do if there's no machines under contract at that store. The difference is when they get it inside the store, instead of having to wait for a service person to come to take the containers back, if that service person is busy doing something else in the store, the machine is constantly available. So sometimes we find that consumers feel that their waiting time is reduced by having the machine.
There are now 4,000 cash for cans machines across the country. Businesses can lease the machines, and Invipco provides accounting and a pickup system. The shredded containers can even be blown into a storage silo where the pieces are sucked up by a vacuum truck. DeWolfson says in addition to recycling, the process also saves energy.
We use the electrical energy that's available from the power service to the supermarket. So they put a couple of additional wall sockets in the wall at the place where the machines are going to be installed, and that provides the power to the machines. And they consume probably in most areas dollars worth of electricity a month. Now that overall saves energy, because if you don't have these machines, then the containers have to be hauled back to a processing point from the store by truck, which is hauling uncompacted containers and therefore hauling air.
An increase in DeWolfson's business depends heavily on the political winds. If recycling was federally regulated, his market would increase dramatically. This will be the case if a federal Resource Conservation and Recovery Act is passed. And the cans for cash machines have been targeted by recycling opponents. The National Soft Drink Association protested when a machine was put in the California State Senate building. The soft drink companies are against refundable cans because the refund increases the price of their product. They view the Senate's use of the machine as an endorsement of container deposit laws. But DeWolfson says that if the current pro-recycling trend continues, his business will play a major role.
We believe that jurisdictions, whether it be states or the national government or even counties and cities, are going to increasingly mandate certain steps to enhance the environment for their citizens. And so we believe that we may see more refund programs in the future.
It may take some getting used to, but DeWolfson says that once a customer tries the recycling vending machine, they often prefer it. With the increasing need for disposal alternatives, that's good news. Bruce DeWolfson is the president of Environmental Products Corporation and the inventor of the recycling vending machine. That's our show for this week. We hope you enjoyed this edition of The Environment Show. For a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-767-1929. That's 1-800-767-1929 and ask for The Environment Show, number 84. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok is the executive producer. This is Melissa Rocker. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.